Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins with your American Cannabis Conversation Quick News. Beijing, China. China must import more hemp from the U.S. under the new trade deal. After years of being one of the United States' main sources of hemp imports, China will now be required to buy a lot more of the non-intoxicating cannabis crop from the U.S. Hemp, which was federally legalized under the 2018 Farm Bill, is one of a long list of agricultural products that China agreed to import on a larger scale over the next 2 years as part of the international trade agreement. The parties acknowledge that trade and economic structural changes resulting from this agreement and from other actions taken by China to open up its economy and improve its trade regime should lead to improved trade flows, including significant increases in export goods and services to China by the United States and other nations. Boise, Idaho. Alcohol-related car crashes decline in Idaho after Washington State legalizes marijuana next door. After Washington State implemented legal marijuana sales for adult use in 2014, the number of drunk driving accidents in neighboring Idaho decreased, a study reported recently. The association was strongest among counties closest to the Washington State border. These findings are consistent with the increased access to marijuana, leading to a substitution away from alcohol to marijuana. The working paper published last week by the Utah State University Center for Growth and Opportunity concluded the research authorized by economist Benjamin Hansen is the first to look at whether cross-border shopping, that is crossing state lines to purchase goods, has an indirect impact on public health. In this case, whether accidents that are the result of alcohol misuse increased or decreased. Hansen's study adds new evidence that when cannabis is legally accessible, people substitute it for alcohol. The work supports his previous research, including another recent study that found that medical marijuana laws are negatively related to alcohol consumption. And we turn to Ontario, Canada for our last story. Cannabis edibles fly off the shelves on the first day of sales in Ontario. The first day of legal cannabis edible sales in Ontario, and in some regions, it would appear that the public had been waiting a long time. At some of the province's brick-and-mortar dispensary locations, as well as its government-run online store, edible products including cannabis-infused teas and candies sold with quickness. The government-run Ontario Cannabis Store, which administers product supply to the province dispensaries, reported that 70 government-approved products, 21 edibles, and 50 vaporized products it had up for sale in its online store, almost all were snapped up within a nearly alarming 15 minutes when they became officially available to customers at 9 a.m. And this has been your America's Cannabis Conversation Quick News. I'm Dan Perkins. Who's joining us on the conversation today? Megan Fox, who is the Director of Communications for the National Cannabis Industry Association, will talk about hearings that began this week in Congress to study the possibility of deregulation and declassification of cannabis. Also on the program today is Emily Flippin from The Motley Fool, who's going to help us understand how to read research and when to question it and when to believe it. We have a segment with our cannabis doctor on call, Jordan Tischler. And we're talking about the DEA recent report of an undercount of 29 billion opioid pills sold in the United States. Undercount. Total now 100 billion pills. And finally, for those thinking about starting a growing business, we have Brett Sneffback, who brings into light the things that people don't know before growing cannabis, selecting the right biomass, equipment, and all the things necessary to build a successful growing program. So let's get on with the conversation. I'm Dan Perkins. Well, welcome back to the conversation. And joining us today is one of our special people, Morgan Fox, who's the Director of Communications for the National Cannabis Industry Association and a longtime contributor to this show. Good morning and welcome to you, sir.
Good morning, Dan.
Thank you. We're going to talk a little bit about today what's going on in Congress. And I want to add another twist to that. Do you think that the Democratic candidates who are all not only talking about decriminalization of marijuana, but some of them want to decriminalize all drugs, how well do you think that's playing with the electorate? So let's start with what update on what's going on in the Hill.
Well, just last week, we had a pretty momentous hearing on the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health that, sort of vaguely was supposed to talk about a number of bills that are currently being considered, but ended up mostly talking about research. And the witnesses were representatives of the DEA, the FDA, and the National Institute on Drug Abuse, all agencies that not only have been staunchly anti-reform over the years, but are also the gatekeepers for any sort of research that could be done on not only cannabis, but also the production of research-grade cannabis for scientists to be able to study. It was a very interesting back and forth. Members that were on the committee were pretty much unanimous in holding these organizations' feet to the fire on why more research applications aren't being approved and why the process is being held up. And these agencies, in typical fashion, passed the buck and said that Congress has to change the law. The reality is that they're both partly responsible in some fashion. But we saw a very interesting development as well from from Representative Kennedy, who up until very recently was an opponent of legalization and has now signed on as a co-sponsor of the MORE Act, basically saying that the committee was planning on having another hearing instead of government agencies bearing witness. They would be speaking with people who had been impacted by the war on drugs. So I think that that's a real big sign of where this conversation is heading and how much it has evolved over the course of years to the point where we're at now.
Well, I saw a little bit of that. I didn't see all of it, but I'm curious. In the many, many conversations I've had with people in the college and university and research area, so many of them are getting funding from DEA. So it's not as if DEA isn't doing anything. They maybe need to do more. But one of the challenges that I hear from researchers, the DEA is saying, at least the last time I heard, you have to buy your cannabis from this single dispensary in, I think it's in Georgia or South Carolina, and that's the only place you can buy it. And the researchers saying is we need to try different strains grown in different conditions, and having one place to buy it is not appropriate in terms of giving us true scientific research. Was there any discussion about that?
Absolutely. So far there's only one legal production facility for DEA approved research, and that's the University of Mississippi. And
I was close.
Pretty much every researcher that I've talked to or heard from has said that the material that they produce is not only not representative of what's available in state legal markets, but oftentimes is moldy and dry and basically impossible to really do any substantive research on. And the DEA has been consistently stonewalling applications from other production facilities to be able to study this. They've also been putting a stranglehold on any sort of research that is attempted to be done on products that are available at the in-state legal markets. And, that's a serious problem because researchers can't effectively study what people are actually consuming on a regular basis. And conceptually, it doesn't make much sense because one of the key things that the DEA mentioned was making sure that any of these producers have tremendous safeguards against diversion, and that includes even the researchers. And that just doesn't make much sense to me because especially if you're located in a legal state, why should a researcher have to have a DEA-approved safe room where they can keep their research materials when anybody that it would be potentially diverted to can just go down the street to a legal retail establishment.
Right. You know, I interestingly, I have a doctor who's been on the show a couple of times, a researcher, and he's studying pancreatic cancer and the impact of cannabis, and he's getting terrific results. He's in Massachusetts, and he started his studies before it was legal for medical purposes. And he had the DEA actually went to Canada and bought the strain that he wanted because they were helping paying for the research. So it seems like they're all over the place.
And that's a pretty rare story. I haven't heard of anything like that before. So I don't think that's the MO of the DEA at this point.
I would agree with you. The other thing is, and we're speaking with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association. The other thing is that a report that came out last week, which, Morgan, I have to say, I was almost in tears when I read it. The DEA admitted that they miscounted the number of legal opioid pills sold over the last 10 years. They missed the number by 29 billion tablets. In the last 10 years, over 100 billion opioid tablets have been sold in the United States. And I believe the number was 163,000 people have died with overdoses. And yet, I think it's fair to say, and you can certainly correct me as an industry association person if I'm wrong, I can't find any evidence anywhere that any person ever died from an overdose of cannabis. And we're not addressing seriously, I don't think, the opioid situation as much as we're spending so much time trying to stop cannabis.
Absolutely. I mean, cannabis might not be as effective as opioids for treating certain types of pain, but it has far fewer side effects and in many cases is very effective. And we're getting more and more research every day showing that it can be useful for treating various types of things that opioids can be used for. We've also seen a lot of data showing that when medical cannabis is available, not only do opioid overdoses go down, but Medicaid expenditure on a lot of prescription drugs, including opiates, goes down as well. So it's basically a win-win for public safety as well as economically. And you're correct. In 5,000 years of recorded use, there hasn't been a single case that's been able to be conclusively shown that somebody died from an overdose of cannabis. So I think that the DEA's priorities are really messed up here, but it's not really surprising. Just in terms of the miscalculation, I think that it'd be interesting to see if this is just a general record-keeping issue with them and see maybe if they can accurately account for where all the asset forfeiture money they've collected has gone.
I'm doing a story about that and more specifically about when they created recreational cannabis in the state of Washington, the state of Idaho saw a decline in DWI, that cannabis is replacing alcohol on the borders of states that don't have it to states that do have it. The other thing is that on this opioid situation, we're spending an enormous amount of money, but we're not talking about the fentanyl and the illegal stuff that's coming across the border from China and other places through the southern border. That's a whole separate issue of the bootleg stuff that's coming in. So in the few minutes we have left, what do you think is the likely outcome of where things are going in this committee?
Well, I mean, it looks like we're going to have another hearing that is looking more on the negative social and health impacts of our current cannabis laws that I think will be pretty illuminating. I think that we're probably going to see the MORE Act continue to make progress through the House. And with any luck, we'll see the Safe Banking Act make a little bit of progress in the Senate, if not get all the way through. On that last point, I think we talked last time about how Senator Crapo had made a bunch of suggestions for what he would like to see in a cannabis banking reform bill in the Senate. And it included things like a 2% THC cap, which would make it unworkable. And last week, NCIA and a number of other trade associations sent a letter to Senator Crapo expressing our desire to work with him on making a workable and effective version of the Safe Banking Act and urging him to also move forward with it as passed by the House. And just earlier this week, a bipartisan group of representatives also sent a letter to Senator Crapo urging him to move forward with the House-approved version as well. So I think we're going to see increasing pressure on the Senate Banking Committee to move the Safe Banking Act forward.
Do you think that the in the committee that you, the most recent hearing, have you seen a significant shift to our side, or is it Kennedy and he's yet, or what's happening with the political situation on the committee?
Well, I mean, I think that we're starting to see the needle bend significantly. I can't give you exact numbers on, how many people have flipped on that particular committee, but with the nature of the questions being asked, I think were very illuminating. You saw a pretty much unanimous request for more research, some of them because they thought that it was due diligence in order to be able to move forward with cannabis policy reform on a larger scale. Some of them because mm-hmm. they want there to be just more research in general so that we know more about the substance and we're already in favor of legalization. Probably a few of them wanted more research because they're convinced that it will show that the harms associated with legalization are worse than the harms associated with prohibition, even though it's pretty demonstrable that they're not at this point. So it's tough to tell exactly how many people have had their minds changed enough to actually vote one way or another. But I think that we're definitely seeing progress, and the overall theme of these conversations has been starting to shift.
We've been talking with Morgan Fox, the communications director for the National Cannabis Industry Association. Morgan, we want to thank you for joining us in this segment. And how can people follow you and find out what's going on at NCIA?
Well, you can check us out at thecannabisindustry.org, and we're also available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Super. Thank you so much for joining us in the conversation today.
Thanks, sir.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
Welcome to the conversation. Today joining us is Emily Flippin from The Motley Fool. And we're going to talk about something different today. We're going to talk about how to figure out what you want to buy by looking around and see what information you can gain. The catalyst for doing this was a research report that Emily and I talked about on a pretty good-sized cannabis company that was questionable. So, Emily, thank you for joining us today. And give us some words of things that what we should be doing when we see these short seller reports or even long reports.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's a topic that is of extreme importance to retail investors because they tend to have reports, these reports like these short seller reports or positive reports tend to have a lot of sway with smaller investors. The report that kind of comes to mind right now is obviously the report from Grizzly Research against Trulieve, and it's had a significant impact on Trulieve's stock. The report did a lot of the classic things that you would expect from a short seller report, going after Trulieve's business, claiming management and accounting fraud issues, a lot of really egregious and unsubstantiated, for the most part, claims. And the stock price as a result for Trulieve has been largely depressed since the report, despite the fact that, up until this point, Grizzly Research was nobody, right? And so you can assume that when people are sending out these short reports, they have some sort of economic interest in sending these reports out. Often it's because they are short the underlying stock themselves, but other times it can be because they just want to gain attention or notoriety for their own business.
So when we look at this particular report, there were some things that you said to me in the pre-show that were obvious to you to question the validity of this report. What were some of the things that were sirens for you?
Well, the first thing is Grizzly Research themselves, who have no history of going after companies in short reports. So unlike a company like Citron Research, which has a lot of whether they're good or not, you know, different decision, but has a lot of back-end research on their part. Grizzly Research essentially has nothing. There is no author on the report, so they had no one to track it back to, no contact information. Simple things in their report were factually inaccurate. Some claims they made about the accounting of Trulieve was factually inaccurate. Even the names of some people they had spelled wrong. So really basic issues like this are good signs to investors if you're reading through reports that, hey, maybe these people have no clue what they're talking about.
But Emily, if I'm a novice investor and I've heard about this and I get this report, how am I going to know that they spelled the CEO or that the financial data is misleading? How am I going to double check not only these people, but in general, how do I verify this information that I'm looking at to be whether it's accurate or not?
What's really interesting about these reports is that a lot of times they make claims that actually can't be fact-checked. You have to take them at face value. So, for instance, Grizzly Research said they flew drones over Trulieve's cannabis cultivation facilities, and the facilities weren't up to snuff. They were, you know, infected, and they made some egregious claims about the pesticides that Trulieve was using. There's really no way for the average person to fact-check this. And so for claims like that, take them at face value, take them with a grain of salt. But for claims which you can do your own research for, whether that be verifying somebody's name, whether that be verifying the reports that Trulieve had actually put out themselves, these are things that if you are a retail investor, you need to feel comfortable doing. Because with reports like these, it's quite literally the bare minimum that you should do just to verify the information that's set aside.
Small investors and sometimes big investors make many decisions based on emotion, whether the emotion is correct or not. And so as a result, they depend upon the emotion of the moment as opposed to the facts of the moment. Are there any other services that we can turn to, like ValueLine or other or S&P, that can help us look at these companies on an objective basis?
I agree with your analysis of the average retail investor making decisions based off of emotions. In fact, when you read research about why the average individual investor underperforms the market, it's largely because people have a hard time not buying and selling based off of their emotions and what they read. And so when you're doing research for companies, it's important not to let your emotions get involved. There were a lot of retail investors who owned positions in Trulieve that sold as a result of this report because that's what they emotionally wanted to do. So there are plenty of unbiased resources out there that you can read. I would say that financial statements are completely unbiased. They're ultimately still presented by the company themselves, but strong research agencies that don't have economic interest in the reports that they make, as in they're not buying and selling the underlying companies, they're giving an unbiased research opinion. They are good for coverage of some of the larger cannabis companies in the space. But a lot of these smaller players that might be interesting to investors don't get a lot of coverage. And it's hard to do research there, but that's also why there's so much opportunity. There are a lot of institutional investors or large investors who won't get involved in this space. There's a lot of under-researched, under-covered companies that you can do your own research on. However, don't put any money at stake that you can't afford to lose, because with the majority of these small cannabis companies, they won't be around 5 years from now. You might hit one on the head, but you shouldn't expect to do that with all of them.
We're speaking with Emily Flippin about from the Motley Fool, being a smart investor.
The way that I've set up the service that I work on, Marijuana Masters, our portfolio, the target allocations, now obviously this changes as stock price changes, but target allocations we have right now is 60% ancillary companies. So these are companies that are not directly involved in the cultivation or production of cannabis companies, but companies that have rather strong underlying businesses and they make investments into the cannabis space. 30% in what we call picks and shovels companies. These are companies that do not produce and sell cannabis, but they mainly do business with other cannabis companies. So you can think about extraction companies or packaging companies as picks and shovel companies. And then 10% left over for the pure plays. These are the companies that are actually the ones who are producing and selling, retailing cannabis. For a lot of retail cannabis investors, they only focus on the pure play companies, when in reality, a lot of the growth in the industry is going to come from picks and shovels and ancillary. So don't overlook those two.
So what I'm about to do is not a commercial, but I want you to help us understand that perhaps maybe services that your organization provides might be one of the things that we should consider in doing our research. So what kind of services would the Motley Fool offer to the small investor who's looking at the cannabis space to put money to work?
Well, as it stands right now, the Motley Fool only has one cannabis-focused investing service. That's the one I work on, which is Marijuana Masters. We're not open for new investors at the moment because we like to make sure that we bring investors on when we think they're good opportunities. We don't want to have anybody, you know, coming in when it's not a great time to be buying. However, there are lots of great free coverage that contractors write for our website. I work closely with a few of them when putting together the initial cannabis portfolio. So lots of free content out there, unbiased content from people who are looking to just cover the space. And even the Motley Fool's flagship services, that Stock Advisor and Rule Breakers, they have exposure to some of these ancillary companies that may not be pure play cannabis companies. They may not be exactly what you think about when you think about investing in cannabis companies, but these services do cover the cannabis industry in other ways as well.
Terrific. Now, in the time we have left, we're speaking with Emily Flippin from the Motley Fool. There is some small movement. We're seeing that the wholesale price of cannabis in some markets has stabilized and starting to rise slowly. Do you see that to be the story in 2020 of the recovery in the price of cannabis?
I hope it will be, but we're still seeing production that has largely outpaced demand. It will depend on how the derivatives market in Canada shapes up to be. I will say that Organigram, which is in my opinion, the best Canada pure play cannabis companies, they reported this week, and they had some really positive news in the price of cannabis. They actually, to that your point about stabilization, saw stabilization in their sales. They keep their costs relatively low, but their CEO, Greg Engel, he did say that he expects to see pricing pressure throughout 2020, maybe not to the extent that we saw in 2019. I hope not to the extent that we saw in 2019, but I think it would be too far to say right now that prices have completely leveled up. And that's largely because we just don't know how much production is going to hit the market in 2020 just yet.
Emily, following that thought, a lot of people are now talking about the demand is greater than the product, and number two, distribution of the product. The number of dispensaries that need to be opened. We had the state of Illinois opened on New Year's Day, and in the first week or so, they did in limited distribution over $11 million in sales. And one of the reasons is there's not a lot of dispensaries open. I know here in Florida, we have a very tightly controlled market, and there are dispensaries, but given the size of the state, not many. Even in California, a lot of places don't have any dispense at all. So when you talk about supply, is demand growing, but the supply of product and the places to buy it are still not growing fast enough?
In Canada, that's 100% what the issue is, and we've seen some provinces change their policies and how they are licensing stores so they can increase the number of stores per capita, you know, hopefully encourage people to buy at their local store instead of buying on the black market or on the illicit market. In the U.S., I think it might be a little bit too early to tell. We see relatively high tax rates and high prices in a lot of these states, at least on the recreational side. And so increasing number of stores could definitely help increase demand. At the same time, you want to make sure that you're taking demand from, like I said, the illicit market and encouraging people to purchase at their local store. It's hard to gauge how much of it is strong underlying demand and how much of that demand is going to markets that we don't get visibility on.
We've been talking to Emily Flippin of The Motley Fool. Emily, how do people follow you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. I believe my handle is Flippin_Emily. I'd love to talk about, you know, any stocks in general, but especially pot stocks. So feel free to reach out to me there.
Emily, thank you for joining us today and joining the conversation.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com. Want to find out if cannabis can help your medical condition? It's time to hear from our cannabis doctor on call.
Joining us in the conversation today is one of my favorite people, our cannabis doctor on call, Jordan Tischler. Doctor, welcome to the conversation.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
We spoke earlier about a report that came out from the Drug Enforcement Agency last week that said they miscounted the number of tablets of opioids that were sold in the United States in the last 10 years. Their count was off 28 billion tablets. They believe that they can track that we've purchased 100 billion opioid tablets in the last 10 years in the United States. And that doesn't count any of the illegal and stuff that comes in over the border. We did a conversation a couple of weeks ago about pain management, and pain management being probably one of the biggest issues in our society today, almost regardless of age. The prescription opioids seem to me, never used them. I hope I never have to. I know when my wife recently had hip surgery, she was on them, but was terrified she had to get off them because she was afraid of becoming addicted to it. But it's clear that it's a problem. We have a foundation called Songs and Stories, and we work with soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder. And at many of the hospitals that we've gone to, cannabis products are not permitted. And so we have the pain management is done with opioids. And we had an interview not too long ago with a Navy SEAL who was wounded 9 times. And all they could give him was opioids. And when he was discharged with a medical discharge, he was an absolute addict. And his family finally intervened when he came home and found him a doctor similar to Dr. Jordan Tischler and weaned him off of all of the opioids. And after 2 years, he was not taking any opioids or any narcotics at all. He was treating his pain management with cannabis. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, doctor, I'm not a medical person. I'm just a talk show host. How did we get to the point that we were prescribing 100 billion opioid tablets over 10 years?
Well, I think that's a good question. But I think that actually the seeds of the answers are in things you've just said, right? Another interesting statistic is that the United States has about 20% of the world's population, yet we consume 80% of the world's opioids. So the real question, I think, is what is it about Americans that is different from the rest of the world such that we seem to need or think we need so much opioid compared to everybody else? Given the fact that we're this lovely melting pot or tossed salad or whatever you want to call, I mean, genetically, we're related to wherever our ancestors came from. So therefore, there probably isn't a genetic reason that Americans are different from, you know, Europeans or Asians or Africans or whoever we're all from. So there's something about our society that is different. We perceive that we're in more pain or need more treatment for pain than other countries with similar populations. I don't think anybody has any idea why that is, but the outcome of that is that we are supplying that you know, billions and billions of opioid tablets. One of the things that we can say definitively is that there are very few clinicians who want to give anybody opioids. And therefore, the driving factor here is not on the supply side, but rather on the demand side. And in order for us to really solve this problem, we have to be able to address what's driving that demand, as well as supply alternative approaches that meet that demand, but do it in a safer fashion. So, you know, and cannabis is amongst those options right there. We are in an awkward position at the moment insofar as we have definitive answers that say cannabis is, in fact, helpful as a medication for pain. That was stated definitively in January of 2017 by the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, which is a government-funded agency. And yet, you know, cannabis remains on the Schedule One, which is means that, according to the government, it has no medical use and it is illegal to use it. Obviously, the states in the various forms have disagreed with that, and we're in a bit of a stalemate. But where this really gets problematic is when you look at major medical institutions, hospitals and such, where almost all of their funding comes from the federal government in one form or another. Those institutions have their hands tied in terms of being able to employ cannabis for their patients. It simply can't be done. We need to move past that. We need to also study why it is that we Americans seem to be in so much pain. You mentioned that there were 160-something thousand deaths due to opioids over that 10-year plan.
Overdose.
Yes, I didn't mean to minimize the last 3,000. But you know, one of the things we also have to remember, well, let me preface it by saying that's way too many. Right. I mean, there's no question. I'm not trying to dismiss those overdoses, but we also have to put it in the context of the fact that there are ongoing between 5 and 15 million Americans with chronic pain in that same. That's actually per year. So if you multiply that by 10, you know, the math is a little fuzzy there. But the bottom line is that there's a much larger group of people who are now being victimized by the government's draconian measures to try to get everybody off the opioids, even if they need the opioids, have been stable on the opioids for a long time, and are getting benefit from those opioids. We can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not as simple as saying opioids are causing X number of deaths, therefore they're bad. There's a much larger group of people who are in pain and need that medicine and are doing well on that medicine. And so we absolutely must address this problem, but we have to do it with thought and nuance, not just saying, oh, everybody who's on an opioid has to come off now, because that's just nonsense. It's not good for anybody.
We're talking with Jordan Tischler, our America's Cannabis Conversation doctor on call. Doctor, you're a medical clinician, and you treat, as you told us several programs before, you treat pain as one of the things that you do. Are you
Absolutely.
Seeing less use of opioids and more use of cannabis in your practice, or has it not changed?
I think what I can say is that people who come in on opioids generally need significantly less. And many people will come to me initially saying, I'm on these opioids and I want to get off them, so can you help me with cannabis? And my response to that is generally that the idea of coming off a medicine is problematic because it sets you up for a failure, right? I mean, if you get off the opioids, that's great. But in many instances, people still need some amount of opioids, and then you end up with a situation where they feel bad because they couldn't get off it, you know? What I tend to do is try to refocus the conversation on the reason that they're taking the opioids, which is the pain. And I say to them, look, our goal here is to get you so that you have a reasonable amount of pain, maybe even no pain. That would be lovely. And cannabis can help us do that because cannabis is pretty good for controlling pain. It's not perfect because no medication is perfect. And so you may be able to come off your opioids, but more likely what we're going to find is that we can dramatically reduce your opioid use. And that's wonderful because the risk associated with using opioids is very much dependent upon how much you're taking. So less is better than more. And with cannabis, we see in a number of studies, as well as in my practice, anywhere between a 40 to 80% reduction in the amount of opioid needed when you add cannabis to the regimen. And I think, you know, that to me is an ideal situation because the patient comes in and we get focused on making them comfortable, and the opioids generally just kind of factor out because, or factor down because they're no longer so necessary because the cannabis is kind of picking up the ball and running with it.
You know, it's interesting, as you said in a previous show, nobody's ever died from an overdose of cannabis, but we got 163,000 people in this country that we know of. Could be much more than that, but 163,000 people who've died by overdoses of opioids. And I wonder if what's driving, I'm not trying to be a doctor here, but I'm just wondering, is the pain that they're experiencing. I know that in talking with doctors like yourself all over the country that what cannabis is doing is allowing alternatives to deal with pain. And I know that the average age now of a cannabis purchaser is in their mid to late 50s, and they're doing it because the other things have not worked or they don't like the side effects and they're looking for something, and cannabis seems to help. So are we switching the culture? And if we made it legal as opposed to illegal, would that change dramatically what's going on or not?
I think we're definitely making progress. You know, the first step here was recognizing that we had a problem with the opioids, which, you know, frankly, was never a surprise to me. So I think that for the people who are paying attention, it was clearly an issue. You know, as we talked about in our previous conversation, the real problem here is that the array of medicines that we have for treating pain is actually remarkably limited. And so bringing cannabis into that equation increases our options by fully a third, and which is huge. And the fact that it is, in fact, safer. And I say safer, but it's not, you know, I don't want anyone to think that this is just a totally scot-free. No medication is scot-free. But in relative risk, cannabis is a better first choice. And the other thing is it's not super for pain control. It's very good. But again, you may in fact have a situation where you need some opioid, but less. And so, again, I'm really making the case that the answer here is one of nuance and thoughtfulness. And the other thing that we also have to recognize is as we move forward with cannabis and exploration of other novel medications spurred on by this opioid crisis, we're going to find things that we don't even have yet, right? So, you know, 10 years from now, after more research is done, then we're going to have more pain and control options. They may be derived from cannabis, or they may be derived from what we've learned from cannabis, or they may be completely other. But the point is that that research is ongoing and needs to get done. You asked about legalization. I'm actually a little worried about legalization. I think that legalization is a great idea from a social justice point of view, and I agree with it completely. But I also think that if it's done, again, without a without proper forethought, and we sort of just throw the barn doors open, we're going to see a lot of shysterism when it comes to selling product, and no incentive to do the homework. I often say this, look, if you want a medicine and you know exactly what it's going to do, risks, benefits, how to treat it, you know, all that sort of thing, then somebody's got to do the studies. They've got to explore it in the lab, and then they've got to take it out in human beings, and that costs a lot of money, like $100 million worth of money. So if you're a cannabis company, even if you had that $100 million, would you spend it if you didn't have to? If you could just take the product and put it out on the shelf, you know, with no proof necessary, why would you do the homework? Why would you spend that $100 million? And the answer is you wouldn't. And if you look at the pharmaceutical industry, which I'm not, you know, saying is perfect or anything, they wouldn't do that homework either, except they're required to, right? The regulation around pharmaceuticals is such that if you don't do that science, you don't go to market. And then if you do that science, you're rewarded by going to market with a monopoly, which for about 7 years you have a monopoly. In which time you're supposed to recoup that money, plus the money for all the drugs that failed to get to market. So, you know, we're sort of setting up our culture to end up with a whole bunch of products, cannabis-related products, that frankly just don't have any proof behind them, and I'm worried about that. So that's part of my hesitation around, you know, carte blanche legalization.
We've been speaking to one of our terrific guests, and guest is Dr. Jordan Tischler, who is our America's Cannabis Conversation doctor on call. Jordan, thank you for a great show.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
And now for some breaking news. U.S. Supreme Court, Washington, D.C. A recent decision on tax fines offers a ray of hope for cannabis industries around the burden of IRS's 280E penalties. The U.S. Supreme Court decision this week not to consider a Colorado Supreme Court ruling on the tax fine, coupled with dissenting opinions on recent cases involving California Medical Marijuana Company, could have significant ramifications on the cannabis industry, according to tax experts. Left standing by the U.S. Supreme Court was a decision holding that the Colorado Department of Labor levied against Dammy Hospitality was an excessive fine or penalty under the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution.
Welcome back to the conversation. We're joined again today by Brent Schnapp, who was on our program previously. And today we're going to talk about product, and he's talking about equipment. And for those of you who are seriously thinking about getting into the cannabis business, as Brent's going to tell you, you need to define your crop, and that'll help define your equipment. So, Brent, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Dan. We were talking earlier about equipment and the need for it. In many cases, you know, experienced farmers may have some of the equipment they need. For example, if they're just going to be doing, you know, grain, you know, using the seed, for example, they may have some existing grain equipment that could work for them. But the real specialty area will come into when you want to do the CBD flower, so which is why we're here. Working in Iowa, for example, with Iowans, they're looking more at a holistic approach where they need to do fiber, the herd, you know, possible ethanol processing with hemp, things like that. But for the sake of this conversation, we'll stick to the CBD side.
If I just say I want to grow the plant, it grows up, it matures, and I harvest it, is there a market just to sell the plant as is?
To sell the plant itself, no. To sell the biomass, yes. And the biomass, I'll define as a dried product, something that's been stabilized either in, you know, typically by drying, but in some cases people have utilized a wet baling system, which is an airtight wet bale. So it depends on really it depends on the scale. if you're going to be doing, you know, and that's the other thing, not only the what you're going to grow, but what scale you're going to grow it at. If you're going to be growing just to get flower for oil extraction, you may be looking at 5 acres. That's going to require a different equipment build out than doing 1,000 acres for to support an ethanol plant. So, and you'd probably need 10,000 acres to do that. So, again, it boils down to what you want to do and what scale. And even on the CBD side, to do large scale on CBD, the harvesting equipment just isn't there to do stuff, you know, at a pure bud form over 100 acres. So, frankly, on the equipment side, I'm going to say it's a bit of a crapshoot if you want to do large scale flower growth. A lot of it's still by hand right now. You can go up on the internet and see on YouTube and see a lot of that happening. Even the large guys are still doing a lot of hand labor. So, you know, I guess on the equipment side, it's going to be a mix of equipment based and hand labor and innovation. There's still a lot to be done with the innovation on the equipment side. We're at the very beginning of the growth curve on that.
So let's go back again. We've got the seed, we put it in the ground, we grow the stock, and I have to do something to it. So in order to make it a cash crop, what is the next logical step that I should be thinking about if I'm thinking about starting a growing business?
My realistic joke is you need to plan on harvesting when you're planting. And you need to do both simultaneously, and it's pretty easy. Planting's fairly straightforward, but you need to make sure you've got you've got to figure out how you're going to harvest it. And typically it's going to break down into two things, a whole plant or top of plant harvest, and then either you're processing the entire, let's say, top, you know, 2 feet of the plant and assuming that most of that's bud matter, and then you're just milling that down and drying it and extracting with that. You could do hand cutting where the plants are hand cut, and then manually, possibly field dried for a bit, and then run through manual bud separation devices, bud rubbers. They've got a variety of different hand bud removal devices that's being used right now, but a lot of that's still hand labor intensive to feed the plants in and out. So once you've got, and I think that's the one thing that most people fail to realize is the amount of hand labor still required for doing medium to large scale processing or any scale processing. You plan on needing more people than you're planning on,
right.
And better equipment than you have. It's going to be trial and error for people just getting into it. Experienced farmers will have several legs up on it, but if you're new to the industry, you know, you need to start networking and learning from other people's trials and tribulations before you jump in cold turkey. That's my biggest advice is networking, gather data, and keep going. You know, listeners listening to this, good job. You're gathering data. Go get more.
Growing it in a building is going to be all hand harvesting. There's really not much of an opportunity for mechanization, even in the small scale. Would that be fair?
Yeah,
okay.
That's also just simply because you're going to have a smaller, you know, I've seen a 5-acre greenhouse, but even then that could be hand harvested very easily. My general rule of thumb is under 10 acres you can hand harvest. You know, you can get anywhere from a half a pound to a pound per plant, and if you've got, you know, anywhere from 1,500 to 2,500 plants per acre, you can start to do math with that. You know, if you're able to get the biomass off the, you know, the plant itself may weigh 4 pounds, you may get, you know, a half a pound to a pound of bud off that.
How much of the plant, when I harvest it, can be used to generate income?
Ideally, all of it. And here's how it breaks down. Ideally, what you're doing is you're able to strip the flower off the plant and do a CBD extraction with it. If there's any seed that comes out of that, you're able to take that seed out and dry it for possible seed usage. And then third, the fiber from the stalks, you're able to do something with the fiber and or the herd out of that. There are some places and some farmers in Colorado that have done that. We sold a dryer to a place, a company well-known in Colorado, one of the innovators, actually. I'll name them Colorado Cultivars. They were out there, and they have an operation that does all three. They do flower extraction, they do fiber, as well as they do seed. And so as much as possible, you're using all of the plant. Now, how much income the proportions of income, you know, 95% of it's going to, if you're doing CBD extraction, most of your income is going to come from that, but you still want to get a full use of the plant and have your mechanisms set up for that. So when the CBD pricing goes down, you've got a balanced use of the entire plant.
Yeah. Now let's talk about equipment. You mentioned in our pre-show interview, and you mentioned it a couple of times in this one, you've referred to the word dryer. New concept for me. Didn't know that you had to dry it. So what is a dryer, if that's the right terminology? What does it do, and why do I need it?
Hemp, grain, any agriculture crop's going to come out very moist from the field. Whether you realize it or not, the grain, the corn, the soybeans that are processed by farmers, those go through grain dryers. Before they need to be dried so that they can be stored. Generally speaking, any biomass above 10% moisture will rot and mold and mildew within it. But below 10%, again, general rule of thumb, if you store it in a cool, dry environment, it won't mold and mildew. So when you harvest your plant, so you see the people hanging their marijuana plants upside down, their cannabis plants upside down. What that's doing is it's drying the plant, but also forcing any of the liquids and the nectars in the plant and the oils in the plant to go down into the bud and into the leaves, so that then when those are stripped, most of those oils have been where they need to be, as well as the plant is dried. So drying has always been part of the process, but now at this large scale, you need to do it mechanically. So drying cannabis mechanically, there becomes a problem. One thing that happens that you need to do if you're going to process marijuana is decarboxylation. Decarboxylation is the process that enables the marijuana or the cannabinoids to be ingested into the body. That transference from a CBDA or a CBD to just a straight CBD molecule, or a THCA to a straight THC molecule, requires the heating of the cannabis at about 220 degrees, anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour. Once it's been heated, then it would be absorbed. An example of that would be, I could go out to an indoor grow and take a large bud off of a plant and eat it. All it would probably do is give me an upset stomach for eating just too much green at once. Now, if I took that same flower, put it in the oven for a half an hour at 240 degrees, and then ate it, I would get quite of a buzz out of it, because my body would be able to adjust those cannabinoids after that heating process. So when you're drying, you need to make sure that you're not accidentally decarboxylating or drying the hemp too much, because once decarboxylation happens, the CBD will just start to degrade faster. So you want to take care to first not decarboxylate your hemp as you're drying it. Secondly, you just want to manage CBD loss. Given that you're heating the plant, there's the possibility that CBD will go off of the plant itself. It'll evaporate or evacuate off the biomass. So you need to manage the temperature and the way in which you dry so that it's CBD friendly, that you're not evacuating the CBD or the cannabinoid molecules off the biomass. So it's decarboxylation and then making sure that you're drying in a CBD friendly manner, which generally needs quick flash heat, higher heat faster rather than lower heat longer is a good rule of thumb.
Is there a place to go? Since this is a controlled substance, where do I go for the business that I want to get into?
Well, it depends on the person's level of sophistication. To start from scratch, you know, I would, you know, maybe send me an email and then I could tell them where to go, I guess. I mean, I get asked that question a lot, and then my usual response is several other questions, and then I can guide people better. But, you know, first you need to go up to your given state's rules and regulations. You know, if you're in Michigan, go Michigan, you know, Michigan hemp laws, and start with the state's official website and see what their rules and regulations are. That's going to give you the framework to operate within. And then just start Googling people in your state that look respectable, that are doing business, start attending events, start meeting people. But really, you have to start with your given state website, your official state's website, and find out. And many states are facilitating businesses here. This is a new business opportunity for many states. So in some instances, you'll find a lot of help there and assistance, state by state level.
If somebody has a question, how do they get a hold of you?
Just brettschneff@gmail.com. My phone number, I'll just go ahead and give it. It's 425-829-2080, 425-829-2080.
Brett, we'll put that information on our website for the show, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today and help educating people who are considering the cannabis business about what they need to do. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.